This land is your land. This land is mine. From California to the New York Island, from the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters, this land was made for you.
Hello, everyone. This is Basma Farhad of the People Speak Radio. Here we believe when the people speak, they make a difference. You can listen to the People Speak Radio live on BBS Radio Tuesday nights from 8 to 9 o'clock Eastern Standard Time or by going to our site at www.thepeoplespeakradio.net. There you can also listen to live or past shows on our iPod Ready Archive section. That's www.thepeoplespeak.net. And if you have a Nokia phone, you can also listen live via satellite. Just go to the website for details. We've got a great gal with us tonight. Our guest tonight is Ellen Brown, author and writer. She is the author of Nature's Pharmacy, a book that I love, and she has also written Forbidden Medicine. And tonight we're going to be discussing, more importantly, her newest book, Web of Debt, which addresses the economy and the way things are structured here in the United States. Hi, Helen. Again, we apologize for dragging you away from the TV. Welcome to our show.
Thank you. It's great to be on your show.
Well, thank you. Today's election day, and everybody's all hyped up and expecting all of these wonderful things to happen. Ellen, what do you think is going to happen?
Well, the stock market was flying, but I write articles. I try to write one every week, and the last two I wrote were on market manipulation. And you just have to wonder. I mean, I do think that the country is just ready for a change, and that's exciting, and so they're ready to jump back and invest. But you do have to wonder because, the economy is whoever wins. We know who's going to win, but whoever wins is going to be dealing with a huge mess. The economy is just not looking so good.
Well, exactly. I mean, honestly, today I was talking to some people. Obviously, the big buzz today on the street corner and every street corner and every place you were and the corner coffee shop was the election, and people are saying things like, Obama's already hedging and saying things like, well, we might have to take this into a second administration before we can really clean this up, da-da-da, and I said, we have a deficit the size of the cosmos.
Right. Well,
what do you want to happen in 4 years? I mean, are we being unrealistic, Ellen, as to what's going to happen over the next 4 years?
Well, it could actually all be fixed, and that's what my book, Web of Debt, is about. But then it is a question whether you can make that point at a high enough level that anybody will hear it. But one good thing about Obama is he appears to be very intelligent and alert, and I've heard some people have said that he's a good listener. So I'll tell you how he can be fixed. The reason we're in this mess is because of our banking system, which is based on an inherent fraud, and it's gone on for 300 years. And what we could do and should do is revert to the system that the American colonists had that they intended to institute after the American Revolution, but they failed. Hamilton, it's a long story. I don't know if you want me to go into all that. But anyway, the problem with our money system is that all of our money comes from banks as loans. Every single dollar is created by banks except for coins, which compose only 1/1000th of the money supply. The Constitution says Congress shall have the power to coin money and regulate the value thereof. And that is all Congress does. It makes the coins, and the rest of it is all created by banks when somebody takes out a loan. And the problem is that the banks create the principal, but they don't create the interest. So somewhere has to be taking out new loans just to find the interest. So it's a big Ponzi scheme, and we're at the end of this Ponzi scheme.
Well, let me see if I can kind of break this down, because doing research, and obviously this has been something that I've looked at through many of our guests and comments that have come up during our shows. What we're looking at here is a system of banking. When you say creating loans, you mean that literally. You mean sitting down at a computer and putting in a loan that suddenly one minute didn't exist and now suddenly exists.
That's right. People think that banks lend depositors money, or that they lend the bank's own money. That's not true. They don't lend either of those things. What they do, they use the depositors' money as reserves. That's called the fractional reserve banking system. But on top of those reserves, they create loans. So they actually are allowed to create 10 times as many loans as they have money in reserve on a 10% fractional reserve requirement. And well, there are many authorities that attest to that, but the way it's done is it's double-entry bookkeeping. So let's say that you take out a mortgage. You give the bank your $500,000, your promise to repay $500,000, and the bank then writes $500,000 into your account. And the way they do it is they say, well, they have a $500,000 liability on one side. That's the money that they have to pay you. And then they have a $500,000 asset on the other side. That's the money that you have promised to pay them back. A mortgage is a negotiable instrument with a present value. So they say their books come out to zero, so they haven't created anything. But in fact, that $500,000 liability that they created on themselves, you spend that in the economy. Those are the dollars that you write checks on, and that's where the money comes from. It's kind of smoke and mirrors, but they create on the one hand, and then they, you know, it's a plus on the one side and a minus on the other side. But that's the problem. The whole system is debt, debt that draws interest. And eventually you run out of borrowers to create the money to pay the interest on the debt. And that's where we are. We've gone around the world and indebted, or the private global banking system has gone around the world and indebted everybody. And there's nobody left to suck into this system.
So basically what is happening is it's like Monopoly money. It's like playing a game of Monopoly, and you have a fake bank and fake money, and we're paying real money to get fake money.
Well, a credit system is a good thing. There's nothing wrong with credit, where you take out a loan, and essentially what you're doing is monetizing your promise to repay. For instance, if you use a credit card, the credit card company does not give you any money. No money changes hands. None of their money comes out of the bank and goes to the merchant. What happens is you have essentially promised, you've signed a thing that says I'll pay at the end of the month. And the merchant takes that little slip and goes to the bank and it becomes a deposit in the merchant's bank. So it's all done with numbers, and the merchant may actually draw out some physical dollars. But still, those are just the dollars that the banks keep on reserve to cover the amount of withdrawals that people make.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Anyway, what you've really done is monetized your own promise to repay, and that's what all our money actually is. It's our own credit, or our own debt, or our own promise to pay over time. So we just have a wrong conception of money, and the way you can fix the whole thing is to make the government be the banker. And the reason that works is if the interest were going back to the government, then you have a contained system, and then it doesn't have to get bigger and bigger and bigger. It's not a bubble that finally bursts, because the government would have the power to also issue some money. I know it's a bit complicated, but...
Can I ask you, so what's happening is that the Federal Reserve is actually not only an independent bank and has nothing to do with the government, but it is an independent bank that is also lending monies to other countries.
When dollars come into existence, the Federal Reserve creates them just by printing them, and trades them. They actually originate with Congress, but what Congress does is they print these little pink pieces of paper called bonds or debt. So Congress can get all the money it wants, and what it does is print these pink bonds. We've seen that there's really no limit to how much money Congress can spend. They're spending debt. They're not spending existing money. They're creating the money that they spend. So they create these pink pieces of paper. They give them to the Federal Reserve. The Federal Reserve prints green pieces of paper and gives them back to the government. Of course, most of it is just written into an account. There's no paper involved. But that's the principle, that the Federal Reserve creates this money for virtually nothing, for the cost of printing it. We print it. We create it for, if it's a $100 bond or $1,000 or $5,000 bond or whatever, for the face amount of the bond. So we're obviously in debt for this money. And all that money that the Federal Reserve is lending around the world now and for the commercial paper lending facility, they're lending to small businesses everywhere. I mean, they're becoming basically the central bank of everyone, not just of the Federal Reserve banks as they were supposed to be. But all that money is based on debt from us, the taxpayers. So it's like trying to pull yourself up by your bootstraps. We're just drowning, and we're trying to save each other, a bunch of drowning people trying to save each other by grabbing onto other drowning people. You shift around the debt, but it doesn't solve the problem. So the way to solve the problem...
If it's fiat money, fake money, that we're printing, that we're just sitting down at a computer, the Federal Bank is anyway, and printing this, why can't we do that? Why can't we as a government do that?
Exactly. That's the solution. We have never had a fiat currency. The definition of fiat, it's French, or Latin or whatever, and it means so be it, and it means the government, that the emperor just created it. He says, let it be. It's like in The King and I when he says, so be it, because it only exists once the king recognizes it. So fiat money is actually money issued by the sovereign. We've never had that. All of our money has always been issued by banks. They used to be called banknotes, and they were supposedly backed by gold. And it was the gold reserve system that was the ruse that allowed the bankers to get control of the system, because they pretended that these banknotes were worth that sum in gold. In other words, you could take your banknote, your $1 banknote, to the bank and get a dollar's worth of gold. But the reason they got away with it was that people only came for their gold 10% of the time, and so they found that they could issue 10 times as many banknotes as they had gold, and that's how they wound up creating the paper money supply, back when it was either paper or gold, before electronic money.
Well, now they consider that the gold standard is no longer the standard for our economic system. Do you think that'll ever return, Ellen?
No, I don't think it can be done. Well, it was a ruse. It didn't work in the first place. I mean, it was that the sleight of hand that allowed this system to develop. But you couldn't possibly go back to a gold standard now, because where would you get the gold? You've got something like $13 trillion in M3 money supply. Nobody knows now because they don't report it anymore.
And yet, people like James Grant consider the gold standard to be probably one of the most elegant monetary systems that was ever created, because it was simple. You had gold to back the money.
Yeah, but it didn't work. I mean, all through the 19th century, there were periodic runs on the bank, and this was because the banks didn't have enough gold to cover all the notes that they issued. And they couldn't have enough. If you had a finite gold system, let's say you started out with $100 in gold, and you let lenders lend $10, principal and interest, compounded annually, in a mere 40 years, let's say they lent it at 5% interest, in a mere 40 years, they would own all the gold, or maybe 6%, I forget. But anyway, it's in a very short time. If you allow somebody to be always taking back more than he puts in, which is the nature of compound interest, or any kind of interest, but particularly compound interest, then very quickly that the lender is going to wind up with all the gold. So the reason you have to have an expandable system, if you're going to allow compound interest, is that you have to have a way to get the money to pay more and more and more, you know, in order to, the only way the parasite can keep this system going is to keep up puffing up the money supply. But I don't
knowing this, well, knowing this, I mean, even with Obama, who claims the this position of change, nobody's ever mentioned any of these things. They're not talking about it.
Well, that's what I even
have. Do they even have an interest in this direction? Let alone the ability to create this in our system of economics today.
That's the thing. There is an easy solution. I mean, it sounds easy, but there's a mathematical solution that would work. But getting anyone to recognize that, because it's so foreign to what we think. Everybody thinks the government does create the money. They think that it's the government's fault that everything's fallen apart, which it is in some sense, because the government, I mean, the Congress has exploited the system for decades where they can print the money. I mean, they can print debt and swap it for dollars and fund whatever they want to fund. But anyway, it's not the government that issues the money, and it's banks don't lend their depositors money. When they did, when the savings and loan actually did lend their depositors money, it didn't work. They went bankrupt. That was the problem Jimmy Stewart had in It's a Wonderful Life. You can't take in people's money and then lend it out for 30-year loans and then have the money when somebody else comes to get his money. It just does.
Let me ask you something, Ellen. Hypothetically, in the case of this cyber money, this currency, and literally that's a term that they're using based on a Harvard study that was done in the early 1950s, cyber money and this currency used, and the Internet, as powerful it is, and people gearing more towards banking online, credit, this energy field of money that's going back and forth and flowing, can they literally shut us down at one point?
Well, they could, yes, under the existing system. But that's why we have to get control again of our money system. We the people, which is the government. The reason nobody trusts the government is that the government has been taken over by the mafia or by thieves or the robber barons of the 19th century. But if we could get it back and set up a proper system, you could insure against that sort of thing. Really what money is, it's merely an agreement between people. It's that the seller wants his money now and the buyer doesn't have it. And so the buyer says, let me pay you over time, and I'll pay you a little extra for the privilege of getting to pay you over time. So that's just an agreement. That's a legal agreement. And what you need the bank for is to be, what you need the middleman for is not to dig gold out of the ground and lend it, or to, you know, not to actually physically deal with this physical thing that we think money is. It's not a physical thing. It's just an agreement. So what you need this overseer for is to enforce the rules. You need a judiciary to enforce the contract and make sure the parties play fair. You need a legislature to establish the rules and have some safeguards like bankruptcy laws so people don't wind up in prison for debts and that sort of thing. And you need a police system to enforce it. So you need a structure in which to conduct trade. And that's all it is. That's all money is a little receipt establishing that somebody has given you value, goods or services, and that you're therefore entitled to go out and spend that on other goods and services of an equivalent value. That's what it was a brilliant system that the colonial Americans came up with all through the 18th century, 18th century. They issued their own government-issued money, and basically what it was just receipts. It was like the government paid for things with these pieces of paper. And then the reason they had value was that they were accepted in the payment of taxes, and so that gave them their stable value.
For those of you that have just joined us, our guest tonight is Ellen Brown, author and writer. We're discussing her current book, Web of Debt, which addresses the economy in the United States today and in the world at large, and how it affects our lives day to day. We have a question, and for those of you that are interested in talking to Ellen, please call us at 877-489-6350 or toll-free in the U.S. and Canada at 888-228-4494. Once again, the telephone numbers toll-free are 877-489-6350 and 888-228-4494. Ellen, we have a question from one of our listeners, and let me see if I can get that up. Pete from Arkansas asked, does Ms. Brown think Obama and McCain's support of the bailout indicates that no matter who wins the election, they will be serving Wall Street rather than the people of this country's economic interest?
I think they were rather bludgeoned into accepting the bailout. Everyone was. And it's because everybody thinks that if the banks collapse, we won't have a banking system, and everybody's afraid of that. But it's because nobody realizes that there's an alternative, which is to create our own credit system. That's what Roosevelt did. But Roosevelt set up, well, he didn't set it up. Hoover set up the Reconstruction Finance Corporation, which was a government-owned bank. And it was set up by Hoover to bail out the banks, but that didn't work because the banks didn't need more loans. They needed customers. So Roosevelt used it to get people back to work again. So he used it for the Homeowners Loan Corporation, the original Fannie Mae, and for all those projects that we've heard about in the New Deal, you know, the Hoover Dam and all those things that put people back to work. And then during the war, World War II, it was used to fund the war. So they got all these factories going with government-issued money. Government-issued credit. The only problem was that they borrowed the money before they lent it, and therefore it put the government into debt. But what you could do is set up that same sort of bank, government bank, but use the fractional reserve lending system. In other words, create the money that you lend. You don't have to put the government
into
debt.
Have an outside creator.
Right. You create credit. What you issue is the full faith and credit of the United States. The U.S. should not have to have deposits or reserves of its own credit to issue credit. That's all our money is. It's the full faith and credit of the United States. So what exactly are we putting on reserve here?
Well, I think I'll tell you, in my opinion, what we're putting on reserve, we are putting on reserve the trust of the people in our administrations, and it is failing miserably. We have let me see if I can break this down. So because I'm the kind of person, Ellen, that needs my fingers and my toes to count to 10. So for me, these concepts have to be broken down in ways that I can understand them. And I think that this is the case for a lot of people because it really sounds more complex than I think it is. And what we're doing basically here is we are creating during the time when you said that they were borrowing money and getting into debt for the war to fund the war. So what they were doing was going to an outside banker, which the Federal Reserve is, borrowing fake money and paying back real interest.
Well, for the Reconstruction Finance Corporation, what they did was they issued bonds, the same thing Congress does. And then people would buy the bonds. And if nobody bought them, the banks would buy them, and they would buy them with money created, you know, with credit, so money created out of nothing, the way banks do. And then the government would take that money and make loans with it, and then to various good projects, you know, agriculture, housing, manufacturing, the things that the country needed. So that was all good. And then when the money would come back, then they would lend it again. The problem was, it initiated as a debt to the government, so it did increase the federal debt. The federal debt went up. That was the beginning of the rise of our federal debt. But you could do the same thing without first borrowing the money. A bank starts with its its reserves, and then it issues loans equal to 10 times those reserves. So what if you had a government bank like the Reconstruction Finance Corporation, a government lending facility, and you took that $700 billion that they just set aside to get everything going again? I mean, basically what it was for was to get the credit flowing again. So you took that $700 billion and you put it into the Reconstruction Finance Corporation, and you said, these are the reserves. Now we are going to lend $7 trillion to the country for all the things we need. With $7 trillion, you could get everything going again. You could bail out General Motors. You could do all those things that we think we don't have the money for. Another thing you could do, this is what I think states should do. I think states are where it should start. One state in the whole country has a state-owned bank, and that's North Dakota.
Mm-hmm.
And so a state can own a bank, and the state banking system is actually separate from the federal system. So let's say a state bought a bank, and then in North Dakota, all the government's money goes into the state bank. That's a law. That's the beginning of their deposits, is the state money goes there. And then they make loans. So a state bank could issue 10 times the amount of its reserves in loans. But what I think they should do is issue 0% loans or 0.5% loans to local governments for all those municipal things that we think we don't have the money for, like roads and bridges. I mean, everywhere transportation and the highways are falling apart. Everywhere they need rebuilding. You could put people to work, mm-hmm. and you could make money doing it. Like if you put in a decent train system that made some money, the money would then go back to pay off the loan. And because it was at 0% interest or 0.5% interest, you would cut the cost of the thing in half. Interest used to be the half the cost of every project on the average. And now it's more than that, because for state and local governments, they can't get what they used to get on their bond issues, so the interest is going way up, so their costs are skyrocketing.
So basically what ends up happening is this money is cycled over and over again within the state, and it never goes out.
Right, and you can create 10 times the amount of money you've got. That's the beauty of it. That's mm-hmm. the beauty of fractional reserve banking.
Well, right here, Sean in Canada asks, what is the alternative to fractional reserve banking, which would have some basis in something tangible?
I wrote a whole chapter on it. Would be good, particularly internationally, to have a standard for valuing all different currencies. But the problem with gold is, first of all, it's a very small market, and the bankers have it. I mean, they can fairly easily manipulate the gold. They can get hold of the gold, and then they can manipulate the value of currencies. But if you had I think the best of the suggestions that I've seen would be to use a consumer price index, which is what it costs to live in a country, basically. But not the manipulated one. You know, the current consumer price index, they've taken out gas and food and housing. Well, those are the three most important things you need. They've taken those out. But let's say you had a real consumer price index that was really what it costs to live in a country, and then you could it would be a basket of things, but it would be a lot of things, enough that you couldn't manipulate it by just buying up one particular commodity.
Mm-hmm.
And they already have those numbers all around the world. Every country already reports its consumer price index. So if you just got a fair standard, then you could see what a dollar was worth in every other country. So if you had a standard to measure your currency by, then you know what value you're getting when somebody pays you.
But wouldn't that have to be rooted in something tangible, or is that again going against somebody deciding what is the standard?
Well, I think that's what we used to think, because we used to think that money originated on the barter system, and that gold was, you know, a real. If you had a piece of gold in your hand, you knew what you had. But today, that sort of standard is easily manipulated. So today, it's actually an electronic standard is actually more fair or more accurate.
Well, more fair, but isn't it just as easily manipulated, Ellen?
No, because the Consumer Price Index is such a broad index that how are you going to manipulate the price of each of the things in the index?
I see. Mike in California asks, what did Ms. Brown think of Congressman Ron Paul's ideas regarding our economy and monetary system?
Well, I thought it was wonderful that he brought up those issues. Nobody else is talking about them. Well, Dennis Kucinich, but those are the only two that talk about them. But, of course, I don't think gold is the ultimate solution, but I don't think Ron Paul thinks that either. He was talking about a sort of a dual system where if you wanted to have gold or, you know, metal coins, that you could do that, which you could, but that just doesn't solve the problem. I mean, it's good to have gold. I have some gold. I mean, it's good. It's a very good investment, but it just doesn't work as a currency. And he would abolish the Federal Reserve, and I think it would be more efficient to nationalize the Federal Reserve, but either one would work. But the thing is, the Federal Reserve does serve a lot of functions. It's the central bank, you know, the central clearinghouse. And you need that. You need it for certain things. So you might, if you just made it into a public institution, something owned by the government, then the whole system works.
Let me ask you a very important question. This is the same question I think that a lot of people get when we're talking about these things, because automatically you come up with the people that believe that this is nothing more than conspiracy theory. And for me, I think it's an insult to the intelligence of people such as yourself, such as many of the other guests that we have on our show that discuss these important things, that have written books, that have taken the time to do the research and to understand the complexities of our economic system and what's happening to it, why, and not only what happened, but how we can fix it. People think that somehow that there's this conspiracy. And to me, when I hear the word conspiracy theory, I think of something hidden, something covert. To be quite honest with you, I don't think that's happening at all. I think it's out in our face. I think that the information is there. I think that none of this is hidden. And I don't understand why people are not jumping on it a lot more. How is this possible?
I agree. It's totally in our face. That whole $700 billion bailout, it's just outrageous what they've done with it. They're not using it for what they said. They made it sound like the whole point of it was to bail out the mortgage, you know, the subprime mortgage holders. Well, you could solve that problem with something like 70 million. Is that right? Seven billion. I don't remember. $700 billion. $70 billion, I guess, supposedly would. But they haven't done it. They haven't used the money for that. And that's obviously not the problem. They've hidden what they were really, really wanted to use it for, which was to get rid of all these derivatives that are bankrupting the banks. And the derivatives on the banks' books are $180 trillion. Mm-hmm. And the credit default swaps on the banks' books of U.S. banks are $62 trillion. So $700 billion is not going to solve the problem. What it is going to do is it's going to allow some lucky banks that manage to get a hold of that money first to clean up their books, and some CEOs to retire in style before the change of elections or whatever, before the whole thing goes down. I mean, it's just
Ellen, how does the bailout benefit the debt spider? How does it feed that debt spider?
What we have is a credit freeze. That's what the big emergency was that nobody can get loans. And the reason the banks can't lend is that they can't meet their capital requirements. And the capital requirement, this is very complicated, but it's imposed by the Bank for International Settlements, which is the private central bankers' bank in Switzerland that you never hear about, but it is the head of the spider. And it's an 8% requirement. So capital is the money you get from your shareholders. It's actually, you know, for equity, for shares, for selling a piece of the bank, and or your profits, like what you get from interest. So it's not reserves, something you can manipulate by depositing, writing checks and then depositing those checks into another bank and then call that reserves. It's the real capital you the actual money you start with. So the capital requirement is risk weighted, and those derivatives are, they were used to supposedly make risky loans unrisky. They're just bets, but they were used as a form of insurance. So you take derivatives, you put derivatives around subprime mortgages and wrap them into these collateralized debt obligations and sell them off to investors. And in that way, the banks were able to move all these bad loans off their books so they can make more loans. But it turns out that the derivatives don't work to protect those loans, that they're not a good form of insurance. And as people are realizing that, those dodgy loans are coming back on the bank's books, then that shrinks their capital base, and now they don't have the capital to make any more loans. It's a function of leverage. So they leverage their base into many times what they had in loans. But when
they're strategically impacting our system too.
Yeah, but then it works the other way. So when those loans come back on the bank's books, you could multiply it by a factor of 10, but then suddenly you've shrunk by a factor of 10. So one loan means you have to call in 9 other loans. You know, one loan that collapses, you have to call in 9 others because it wipes out that portion of your capital. So anyway,
well, we have a lot of questions. We have a lot of questions. We are going to take a short break right now, and we will be back with Ellen to discuss more of this fascinating topic. Thank you, Ellen. This is Ellen Brown, author and writer of Web of Debt. We'll be back in a moment.
Are you appalled that our country is spending billions on war while cutting funds for our libraries, hospitals, and schools? Are you heartsick at the suffering of the Iraqi people? Then join me, Medea Benjamin, in signing Code Pink's urgent call for peace in Iraq. Sign on today at www.womensaynotowar.org.
We teach them how to tie their shoes. They teach us how to live our lives. We teach them long division. They teach us how to bank online. Our children will always outgrow us, but for the first time in generations, they may not outlive us. Over the last 25 years, the percent of overweight children aged 6 to 11 has doubled. The percent of overweight teenagers tripled. Obesity kills. Heart disease, high blood pressure, diabetes, all are linked to obesity, a problem that could be greatly reduced just by having a place to exercise. Right now, people are working hard to put parks and playgrounds where children live, where children will use them. Finding out how you can help is as easy as tying your shoes. Log on to earthshare.org now, a public service message brought to you by EarthShare and the Ad Council.
We used to write letters to each other a lot, and it was intimidating to talk to him sometimes because he just seemed so isolated by himself.
She started talking about how she wishes that her life was over and she wishes that she was never born.
So I knew he had depression, but I didn't know it was that far.
Said something to me about killing himself.
Tell somebody, tell an adult, counselor, parent, whatever.
It's a hard situation because you do risk making that person very angry and losing their friendship.
It would have been horrible for me if she never talked to me again, but I'd live with it because I know she'd be alive.
Definitely worth getting help, even if you think you're going to lose a friendship, because it's better to lose the friendship than the actual friend.
Suicide is one of the leading causes of death among teens. For more information, contact the American Foundation for Suicide Prevention, 888-333-AFSP, or online at afsp.org.
This land.
Join us on The People Speak for an hour of live interviews and audience interaction as guests of various organizations share their work and strategies which impact the world and make a difference. That's the People Speak every Tuesday, 5 to 6 p.m. Pacific, 8 to 9 p.m. Eastern, on the BBS Radio Network.
This land was made for you and me.
Hi, this is Willie Nelson from Normal. For 30 years, Normal has provided a voice for the millions of Americans who smoke marijuana responsibly. Thousands of sick and dying patients find marijuana effective as a medicine, including cancer, MS, and AIDS patients. 9 states have legalized its use. To learn how you can help, contact Normal at www.norml.org or call toll-free at 888-67-NORML.
In a world of abundance, hunger is a crime. When a malnourished child dies, we're all guilty. Yet it happens every 5 seconds. Let's do the right thing. Put hunger away for good. Please, give to the world food program.
This land is your land. This land is mine. From California to the New York.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to the show, The People Speak Radio. Our guest tonight is Ellen Brown, author and a fascinating woman that has written an incredible book. The Web of Debt is just from everything that I can tell, and there are excerpts online for those of you that are interested. What is the website? Please announce it.
It's webofdebt.com, and I would recommend ordering from there, because if people go to Amazon and they've got an edition up that's not available, but the book is definitely available. It's just that the first thing you'll get on Amazon is the one that's not available.
The interesting thing is, and this is wonderful, that you have an excerpt, the introduction, and actually a full chapter from the book, which is fascinating, based on The Wizard of Oz. Don't ignore that man behind the curtain. Doesn't that sound familiar?
Well, The Wizard of Oz was written in the 1890s. It grew out of the populist movement, and that's what I think we have to have again, another populist movement, because it's up to us to wake up our congressmen. We can't just, we've seen that we can't wait for the leader. We have to help the leader. We have to be the movement behind the leader. We have to be the grass, you know, that waves, that moves. So in the 1890s, The Wizard of Oz is a very strange plot if you think about it. It's, you know, these four people marching to a city to ask a wizard for help. Well, the basis of the plot was the first ever march on Washington was in 1894, and it was a group of greenbackers who marched all the way from Ohio to Washington, D.C., to petition the government to return to the greenback system, which was government-issued money. It was the system of Abraham Lincoln that it was only actually in effect during the Civil War, and then they started recalling the greenbacks, and there was a big depression because the money supply shrank. They didn't have the money that they used to have, and all they had was they had to borrow gold from the bankers. They didn't have gold, and so they wound up in debt to the bankers, and the farmers were losing their farms and so forth. So it was a huge depression, just like was as bad as the 1930s, although you don't hear about it so much. So anyway, you can trace all the characters are something significant in that whole movement. So
I think they
said that. Very interesting theme.
Yeah, I think you said that you had your the scarecrow represented the farmers, the Tin Man represented the trade workers, and I thought to myself, boy, how really it. After all, everything is a metaphor for everything else in life. This is my own personal belief system. Now, let me ask you something, and I think that this is something that is really critical. No matter what we say, we are globalizing, and our world has shrunk. we have become, look at us, talking in real time from one place to another. We have listeners in Australia. We have listeners all over the UK. Because of this, and because of this spider that is in building a web around the world. Okay, so let's say we fixed America. We fixed it, and we started making our own money. The government started making its own money, and we recovered from this dilemma, from this catastrophe that has hit our country. How do other countries recover from this?
If we fixed ours, they could fix theirs, because everybody's hooked in. I mean, we are still the world's reserve currency, even though they're breaking out, you know, they're branching out into other currencies. You could fix the entire third world debt problem, because those loans were loans of money that didn't exist until they were issued. That's the nature of a bank loan. So all you have to do to forgive all those third world debts would be, it's just an accounting entry. All you have to do is say the banks don't have to balance their books. And
it almost sounds comical.
Too easy, I know.
Doesn't it, Alan?
Well, take a third world country in 1980, the interest rate went up to 20%. Do you know what a 20% compounded interest rate does? I don't have the figures, but anyway, in a short time, I think in 20 years, you've increased your debt by 38,000%, I think, or 3,800, I don't know, a lot, anyway, hugely. So these countries have paid off their debt many times over in terms mm-hmm. of, they've paid off the principal many times over. So it's
right.
not like it would be just a free gift to them to forgive these debts. We should have forgiven them long ago. A country does not have the ability to go bankrupt. Like in the U.S., we have bankruptcy laws that keep us from enslaving people to their debts. But if you're a country, like the Philippines, say, that you're just stuck. You're a slave. If this bigger power says that you owe them money and they don't make some provision for forgiving the debt, you're stuck with it. But a fair world court of some sort could say, well, you've paid that debt. You've paid that more than once, so you guys are off the hook. And all you have to do
in
is write
a world court, and that's the key. And you know, when you were talking about having a legislative body that, in order to understand how, you know, people would be going to jail, like you said. But isn't this a form of coercion that we're using to control other countries? John Perkins seems to think that economic hitmen were sent specifically to do this, to use this debt to collapse governments and to crush economies at will if they didn't do our bidding.
It is, but it's all a function of the spider. It's a function of a parasitic system that has to be fed profits and more profits and more profits. If there's somebody always drawing profits off the top, then you have to go around exploiting. You can't. It doesn't work as a self-contained system. But if you don't have to exploit. In other words, if you only need enough to get along, I mean, I'm not talking about a communist system or anything, but if you set up a proper credit system, then we could be self-sufficient, and most countries could be self-sufficient. I mean, they've got land, they've got minerals, and if you put the energy into developing alternatives instead of into exploitation and wars and so forth, if you put that money into developing these algae that create energy and wind farms and if you could create the credit interest free, you could make all those energy systems be not only affordable but actually profitable.
Okay,
the reason
here's
they're
the
not
question.
Profitable is because of the interest.
Here's the big
some
question.
Some big investors have to be paid.
Who are they? Who are they that are doing this to the country? To the world? Who are these people? What are their names? How do we identify them? Who are they?
Well, the big bankers, of course, are in charge, but it's still the system that's wrong. If you took those people out, other people would take their place. I mean, at one time, you know, it was a race that always got blamed. It was everybody blamed the Jews because they were allowed to do usury when nobody else was, and they, like mm-hmm. in Russia, they didn't have anything, but they did have the ability to do banking. So, I mean, but that was just an historical fact. If they hadn't done it, I mean, now, if you
somebody
look around...
Somebody else would have.
Yes, yeah, somebody else would have. And the people capitalizing are you certainly can't say that, you can't say every Jew is a banker, and you can't say every banker is a Jew. It's people will capitalize on a system that allows them to. Well, you know that movie Wall Street, that was supposed to be a criticism of that mentality of exploiting and making money off of, mm-hmm. you know, just making all the money you could just on a system which had to mean that somebody else was losing money if you're getting all that money for just manipulating money numbers. But in fact, it became like the standard, and everybody admired those. They wanted that. They wanted to. People, that's human nature. If your system is set up that way so that it's good to be a Wall Street investment banker and everybody admires that, then everybody will do it, even though it's a corrupt system.
Mm. We have a question from Karen in Pennsylvania. By the way, folks, why don't you let us know how the polls are doing in those? We probably are starting to get some more interesting numbers in. I already called my brother in Kentucky and told him that I thought they were crazy. They were the first state to come in. Karen, in Pennsylvania, what is Ms. Brown's best-case scenario for this country's economic future if McCain wins, or if Obama wins, or is there a difference?
Well, my hope is that if Obama wins, that I'm hoping for some enlightened funding. That's the first thing we have to do is let the banks go. That's what I would say. Either one will have to let the banks go. I think maybe it doesn't really matter who gets elected. They both have a huge problem on their hands, and neither the proposals. The current proposals for solving it aren't going to work. And so either way, you're hoping for getting some good advisors who actually understand the problem. I think what you have to do is let the banks go. There is no way to bail out these banks. You can't bail out a $180 trillion derivative scheme. So, but the reason we're desperately trying to prop up these banks, is because we don't realize there's an alternative. But there is an alternative, and that is to set up a public credit system. Credit is like libraries. You go to the library and you borrow a book and you give it back. That's what credit is. You go to the public credit facility and you say, I don't have the money now, but let me give you my promise to pay over time, and I'll work hard and I'll pay it back over time. It's not something that has to pre-exist. It's just credit. It's just a promise that you execute. You work and you pay it back. And they give you these little tokens that are called money that you can spend in the meantime on your representation that you'll pay back. Anyway, either party is going to have a huge, huge mess on their hands. And you can almost see either party being relieved that the other party got stuck with it, because then they can blame the other party for everything going wrong, because there's certainly no simple answer the way they're doing it. I mean, mathematically, they're stuck. There's no way to get out of the mess they're in. But except to change the system. And so that's my hope, to get some light on the subject so that they actually see that that system's not going to work. They've got to just let it go, and they can let it go without destroying the country. All you have to do is you move over into this other system, set up state banks, set up a state lending or a federal lending facility like the Reconstruction Finance Corporation.
Well, I'll be quite honest with you. I absolutely agree with you. I believe that, and this is something that I've often said that people will say, well, why are you so negative? I said, I'm not negative. I'm very positive. I know that there are opportunities for us to change this. The only problem is we're not using them. We are accustomed to the system as the status quo, and we haven't developed the strength or the power as of yet to literally disassemble the current system and reassemble a new system, which takes a lot of work.
Mm-hmm. And everybody's afraid of that transitional period where you have to let the old thing collapse, and then everybody's worried about, well, what are we going to do when it collapses? But that's the thing. You could build the new system. This is what I think we should do. Just build the new system, and don't worry about the old one, and just let it go. You don't have to force the banks down. I mean, there is a monetary reform group theory that you have to force the banks to, you know, not create money out of nothing. It's the 100% reserve solution. But you could just ignore the banks and just set up a public lending facility. This is what they did in Australia and New Zealand during the Depression. They just let their banks go. They didn't say, you know, you can't do what you're doing. But the banks weren't working, and so they set up their own. They had a public central bank. The central bank was government-owned, and it just issued credit, and it built all the stuff that, you know, it did New Deal-type stuff, but just by issuing credit, not by borrowing the money first. They just issued it, and it worked really well. And then, and so New Zealand, for instance, avoided the Depression by doing this, and it worked so well that in the 50s, the bankers looked, well, somehow the Congress or whatever looked around and said, well, we don't need that anymore. You know, everything's fine now. We don't need a publicly owned central bank, so we're going to privatize. And that's when they started having the same problems that everybody else has. They got, I heard actually from somebody from New Zealand that besides that, the Bank of England threatened them that they had to get in line with the program or they weren't going to be in the British Commonwealth system of trading goods and so forth.
Very interesting. And yeah, I think people always forget the middle ground. We're so polarized anymore that we only think in black and white. We don't, and we forget that there are options that we can make smoother transitions, I think, in this system. And I think that's probably what everybody's afraid of, is that because we see it as a black and white situation, and we haven't got the vision right now to see that there is a possibility of just establishing the new system without disrupting the old system, and eventually it would just take over. The transition would be there. Everything would be in place. It would be a lot less tumultuous for people. But, you know, again, you know, and I don't want to let you go until I've asked you this. I think that I want everybody to know that your book on Nature's Pharmacy is a fantastic book. I have it in my own library. You know, some of the some people will say that that's quite a leap going from Nature's Pharmacy to a Web of Debt. But is it really, Ellen? I don't see. I think that there are a lot of similarities in the pharmaceutical companies as well as in the banking industry.
That's how I made that leap. After Nature's Pharmacy, I did that with a collaborator with Lynn Walker, who's a pharmacist turned. She has a number of degrees, but moved into alternative. And then I did a book called Forbidden Medicine. It was about a cancer therapist who was, well, I'm an attorney, and I represented a number of alternative health practitioners, but he was one, and he was a Tijuana cancer therapist who got kidnapped by the FBI, et cetera. Anyway, he actually did have a what appeared to me to be a cancer cure. I mean, he used many things, but these natural things actually did work. And there actually was an attempt by the drug cartel to they went after him because he was sort of an easy target because he was so popular in Tijuana. But there's actually documented evidence that they were trying to shut down all the Tijuana clinics as competitor, you know, it was a threat to the cancer industry and so forth. So I read Ed Griffin's book, World Without Cancer, which linked the drug cartel with the banking cartel. You know, it all goes back to the 1900s with Rockefeller and so forth.
Well, that's a whole other show, and we're going to have to bring you back one day to discuss that because as a holistic healer myself, I'm fascinated by that aspect of it and the understanding of how corruption has infiltrated holistic lifestyles and alternative practices. Ellen, thank you so much for being with us tonight. Good luck with your book, Web of Debt. And again, your website, www.webofdebt.com.
Please go to it and read the excerpts and get the book. It's a fascinating read, and it'll help you to understand and to become more awakened. Next week, our guest will be Naomi Wolf, author of The End of America. It's a pleasure having you with us, and good luck with your work.
Thank you. It was a pleasure being on.
Bye-bye, dear. Good night, everybody. Goodbye. That's it, and let's get back to the election process. Let's find out if we've made history or if we've just made another big mistake. Goodbye, everybody. We'll see you next Tuesday night.
Goodbye.